This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. This past May, officers in Habersham County, Georgia, executed a drug raid, and in it, a toddler was severely injured and burned when a police flashbang grenade was thrown into the child's playpen. Police were acting after an undercover drug buy, and they were using special response team, a no-knock warrant, and full paramilitary tactics. A new study by the American Civil Liberties Union highlights tragedies that happen when SWAT teams are used for police work once thought outside their scope. Do you think police have gotten too aggressive using military tactics, gear, and weapons and no-knock warrants? Or do you think that these are justified? We live in a much dangerous time now and that this militarization should be part of their arsenal. Give us a call. We want to hear from you. The number is 210-614-8980, and you can also email us at thesource@tpr.org. Our guest this half hour, Radley Balko. He is an opinion blogger for The Washington Post. He's a former policy analyst for the Cato Institute, specializing in civil liberties issues, and he's written the book Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Force. And also Kara Dansky. She is a senior counsel at the American Civil Liberties Union. Welcome to The Source, both of y'all.
Thanks for having me.
Kara, let me ask you about this report that y'all have, War Comes Home, the Excessive Militarization of American Policing. What's in the report?
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on. And the example that you bring up of what happened outside Atlanta is a good example, in part because the police in this case conducted a raid of a person's home, searching for a person that they thought was suspected of being involved in a pretty low-level drug deal. He was only accused of being involved in a drug deal that was about $50, is my understanding. And they raided this family's home at 3 in the morning, and they threw a flashbang grenade into the house, as you said, landing in a baby's crib, and that baby's critically injured. But the thing to keep in mind is that they didn't actually find any guns or drugs in the house. And so that example is, we think, but one example of really unnecessarily aggressive paramilitary tactics that the police are using across the country. And I should also say, you know, in our report, we're careful to explain that we're definitely not opposed to the use of SWAT teams for situations where they're really called for, real emergency situations where people's lives are on the line. But what we're seeing, unfortunately, over the last several decades, and especially in the last decade or so, is the real unnecessarily aggressive use of these paramilitary tactics, particularly in low-level drug cases, often for the use of serving search warrants for some pretty small amounts of drugs.
Radley Balko, the author of the book Rise of the Warrior Cop, is there some sort of incentive that's driving this, that we're using the SWAT teams to do low-level drug policing?
I lost
him. And Radley, are you there?
I lost him.
Okay, all right. So let me go to the calls. We've got a couple of callers here already. The number is 210-614-8980. Let's get Michael on the line. Michael, are you there? Go ahead. Okay, we're having a little bit of technical difficulty there. And so to be clear, do I have...
Kara is there.
Kara, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, Kara. So tell me about... escalation? How do we know this is increasing?
Sure. Well, let's start with the 1990s when Congress enacted a law that created what's known today as the 1033 program. It's called that because it's 1033 is where in the statute that exists. But this program authorizes the U.S. Defense Department to give away free of charge military weapons to state and local law enforcement, and it's been in existence, as I said, since the 1990s, and it was really created for the purpose of arming local police with military weapons and tactics for the purpose of conducting the drug war and for engaging in counterterrorism operations. So this program's been in place for decades, and you can go actually to the website of the Defense Logistics Agency, which is the agency within DOD that administers it, and you can track the amount of money that's been spent over time on this program, and it's been increasing. In addition, we know that some research has been conducted by a researcher named Peter Kraska, and he's at Eastern Kentucky University, and he did a couple of surveys back in the 1990s and early 2000s, and he estimates that the number of SWAT teams has increased exponentially over the country, and also that the purposes for which the SWAT teams are being deployed have changed over time. And this is totally consistent with our research. He found that several decades ago, SWAT teams were deployed mainly for the kinds of emergency situations that I was describing. When I say emergency, I mean situations like hostage-taking situations, active shooter scenarios, barricade scenarios. These are real emergencies where people's lives are on the line. And this is what SWAT teams were created for several decades ago. But what Peter Kraska's research showed was that at least into the 2000s, the use of SWAT had shifted, and police departments were using SWAT increasingly to serve search warrants in drug cases, often, as I said, for pretty small amounts of drugs. The difference that we found, our research confirms Dr. Kraska's research. The difference with our research, though, is that we were looking at raw data that we got directly from police departments in response to a public record request. And so we actually examined raw police reports from SWAT deployments of over 800 deployments. We conducted a statistical analysis of those 800 deployments. And that, as far as we know, had not been done before in terms of the analysis of the raw data. And so our analysis of that raw data confirms what Dr. Kraska had found back in the 2000s, that the use of paramilitary tactics and equipment is expanding and is being used increasingly in circumstances where it's really not warranted, and in fact where the use of paramilitary weapons and tactics escalates the risk of danger, as we saw in the Atlanta case that you mentioned and as we've seen in a number of other cases.
Bradley Balko, we have you back, right?
Yes.
Okay, great. So what about incentive? We have police departments. Are they getting some sort of federal money when they use SWAT teams to go for these drug raids?
Yeah, well, there are a couple ways they can get money solely for using SWAT for investigative purposes. The first is that, yeah, there are federal grants that are tied exclusively to drug investigations. The Byrne grant is one. Another is the high-intensity drug trafficking area program where if you can get designated, if your area can get designated as high-intensity drug trafficking area, it comes with a bunch of federal money. So there's actually a strong incentive there to make as many drug arrests as possible at any level so that you can qualify. The other is through asset forfeiture, and this is a policy where if the police raid your house and they could connect even very loosely anything in your house or your house itself to some sort of drug activity, they can seize the property, and you know, if it's cash, the cash goes directly to the police department in some places. In others, they auction off your car, your house, and that money goes back. So there's to the department. So there's a direct incentive there also to use these SWAT teams for drug investigations.
Okay.
And you know, they're somewhat expensive to maintain.
So, sure. So Bradley, we're going to get back to that. We're going to talk about no-knock warrants, how they came about, and how SWAT teams came about, and what some of the pushback that we're having now. This is The Source on KSTX. We're talking about the militarization of police, the overuse of SWAT. We'll be right back after this. This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. I grew up watching the television show SWAT. That was the special weapons and tactics team, a highly trained group of guys that would take on some of the toughest assignments, hostage situations, live shooting action situations. But since then, SWAT has had some mission creep. Now it's being used for not-so-dangerous situations. At least they become dangerous, though, when the SWAT team shows up in the middle of the night with a no-knock warrant. At least that's the finding of an ACLU report called War Comes Home, the Excessive Militarization of American Policing. And with me to talk about that right now in this half hour, we've got Bradley Balko. He's a Washington Post reporter and a Cato Institute fellow, the author of the book The Rise of the Warrior Cop, and Kara Dansky. She's a senior counsel at the American Civil Liberties Union. And we've got you, some phone calls. Let's get you on the air. The number is 210-614-8980. And Michael has called in. Let's get Michael on the air. Michael, welcome to The Source.
Thank you, David, for taking my call. Considering that America's war on drugs has utterly failed, I do not believe these types of violent military tactics are justified. There are some very disturbing instances of violence by SWAT teams on innocent people at alternet.org and policestateusa.com. My question is, since white-collar criminals, such as drug money-laundering bankers and fraudulent investment scammers, are just as likely to hide evidence of their criminal activity, why are these tactics not applied to such crimes, which have an even greater impact on society?
Okay, Michael, thank you for that call. And so, Radley, can you respond to that?
Yeah, I guess I have two responses. First is that is happening, actually. We're seeing increasingly SWAT tactics used for white-collar crimes, for administrative warrants. Any federal agency that has a inspector general now, its own armed law enforcement division, and included in that are these SWAT-like high-risk warrant units that do serve warrants with the same kinds of tactics. We're also seeing in St. Louis County last year there was a warrant served, an administrative warrant for a white-collar crime. A local news station asked the St. Louis County Police why the SWAT team was used. The response from the police spokesman was that all search warrants in St. Louis County, Missouri, are now served with the SWAT team regardless of the crime. So we're seeing this. I don't think that's a good thing. I don't think the answer here, to the inequality problem is to start using SWAT on everyone. I would rather see it, drawn back to only those emergency type situations where it's appropriate.
Well, using it on all situations, I guess that might be better than using it only on certain types of people. Have we seen SWAT teams being used on, is there a racial element to that, Kara?
Well, I think that the caller's point about the war on drugs is a good one. I think that it's undeniable that communities of color have been experiencing the use of unnecessarily aggressive policing, including the use of paramilitary tactics and weapons in their communities for decades. We certainly found that of our analysis of 800 SWAT raids over the course of 2 years, 2011 and 12, that people of color were unfairly likely to be impacted by the use of paramilitary weapons and tactics. So I think that that's absolutely true. I think it's absolutely a huge part of this problem. I don't think, though, that the answer to that problem is to use SWAT to serve every search warrant. We've seen over the course of decades, the Fourth Amendment protections have really been eroded, and you mentioned the use of no-knock warrants. Often the police will have a warrant to search a person's home based on, what they think is probable cause to believe that the person either has some kind of contraband or has committed some kind of crime. But the use of a no-knock warrant brings it to a whole other level. When the police have a no-knock warrant, they have almost unlimited discretion to use whatever tactics they think are necessary, and there's really no oversight over the police in their determination of what kind of tactics are necessary to serve a no-knock warrant. So they quite often will use paramilitary tactics to break down people's doors, arrive in the middle of the night, use really extreme tactics that are traumatizing to the people who experience them.
And they're also they trigger aggressive situations.
They do. We've seen over and over again the use of unnecessarily aggressive tactics triggering, as you say, violent encounters with people who are in their homes when their homes are being raided.
Now, the Castle Doctrine, that is a foundation of common law. How do you have no-knock warrants and still have a Castle Doctrine occur?
Well, so several decades ago, it was determined by the Supreme Court that if the police had a warrant, they were required, traditionally at common law, to knock and announce their presence before being authorized to enter. But the court found that if certain circumstances were met, including the possibility that somebody inside would be able to destroy contraband, often that was understood to be drugs, that the police could serve the warrant simply by entering the home without complying with the traditional requirement to knock and announce their presence. Later, it was determined that if the police believed in advance that those circumstances were met, that they could get a special kind of warrant that's referred to as a no-knock warrant. This is a warrant in which the judge or the magistrate signs off in advance of execution that the police are authorized to force entry, essentially.
Let's get another caller on the air. Rafael has called in. Rafael, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, hello. My name is Rafael Gonzalez. I'm actually the chapter leader of my school's local SSDP chapter, which stands for Students for Sensible Drug Policy. And looking at the situation with the SWAT, I mean, it's basically cops are looking for excuses to show off their shiny new guns, but the whole way it was funded was through the drug war, which really has not benefited anything at all in America. All it's done is increase our prison population exponentially. And, I mean, it's still continuing to this day, and cops are serving no-knock warrants. And what this does, this creates a distrust in the community towards the police. So, really, this is really negative. And then, I mean, you got people or police walking around in, like, battle armor suits. I mean, how does me as a citizen, how does that make me feel? I feel like they're trying to go after me, you know? Like, I mean, it's just the war on drugs is wrong, but yet we keep it, and I don't know why. And I'm actually interested on the research that's going to come out in Colorado if the use of SWAT goes down, if it has gone down since legalization.
All right. I mean, Rafael, thank you for that call. Appreciate it. So, Radley, the militarization of police, even showing in their uniforms, are definitely trying to show a different sort of side of themselves now with, this military-style uniform.
Yeah, well, I think the weapons and the tactics are one problem, but I think this is a component of militarization that I think is often overlooked, which is that, you know, the police are told every day that they're fighting a war of some kind, a war on drugs or a war on crime, war on terror. And they're also, you know, constantly being told that every interaction with a citizen could be their last. They're given military-type uniforms. A lot of departments are switching to these what they call battle dress uniforms. In some departments, you know, SWAT teams are just wearing straight camouflage now. But I think there is a mentality that goes with that. I mean, if you address a cop in military clothes and train them in military tactics and use military terminology, at some point, that officer is going to start looking at himself as a soldier. And that, we have a long tradition in this country of keeping the military out of domestic law enforcement for the very reason that a soldier's mindset is not appropriate to domestic policing. And I think we're kind of taking a back door to that through the militarization of police.
Tomorrow will mark 6 months exactly that Colorado has adopted legalization of marijuana. So, Kara, has there been any sign of reduction in use of SWAT teams there?
I think that'll be a great thing to track. Colorado was not one of the states that we looked at closely in connection with this investigation, but I think that raises a really important question. But I also wanted to get at something that your caller mentioned, which has to do with undermining public trust in law enforcement, and I think that that's critical, and I don't think it can be overlooked. We found in the course of this investigation that law enforcement does not speak with a unified voice on this issue, and there are definitely some members of the law enforcement community who believe that it's important and helpful for the police to be engaging in paramilitary tactics and equipment, but there are a number of police officers out there who think that engaging in these kinds of militaristic tactics really does undermine public confidence in law enforcement, which ultimately erodes public trust and public safety. So it's important to get that voice out there and to let it be known that by engaging in these kinds of militaristic tactics, the police are actually undermining their own ultimate objective, which is to protect and serve.
Our number is 210-614-8980. And Radley, you write in your book, The Rise of the Warrior Cop, that our founding fathers were very reluctant to use the military to do police work. They really wanted to keep it separate.
Yeah, well, I mean, in the streets of Boston before the American Revolution, this was one of the sore subjects. In fact, it's why we have a Fourth Amendment, was the fact that the British had stationed troops in the streets of Boston to enforce the important tax laws, and the animosity that built up between the residents of Boston and the troops, and ultimately culminated in several violent incidents, most famous of which is the Boston Massacre. But it was this use of the military for day-to-day law enforcement, the authority they had to break into homes, to do searches for contraband, that really instigated a lot of the revolutionary fervor in Boston. By some measures, if you look at the raids that they were doing then with these general warrants and compared them to raids that we do today for, say, pot, they're actually pretty mild. They weren't allowed to be done at night. They had to knock and announce themselves and wait for somebody to let them in. The raids that actually kind of prodded us toward revolution were quite a bit milder than the raids that we see 100, 150 times a day in the United States today.
Okay, real quick, caller Cynthia. Go ahead. You're on the air, Cynthia.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Well, my question is, you know, as a community, what steps do we need to take in order to pressure or influence our local police departments that we don't want the SWAT to be involved in low stakes or low crime, that they should only be used in, you know, the types of situations that traditionally SWAT was called out for?
Thanks for your call, Cynthia. And so, Kara.
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of the things that we're doing is working with local law enforcement agencies across the country to put in place policies and procedures internally to ensure that the use of SWAT is limited to occasions when it's really needed, such as the emergency scenarios that I described earlier, and the community actually definitely has a role to play in this. So work with local law enforcement, encourage local law enforcement to enact these policies and procedures and to implement some form of transparency and accountability. A huge part of the problem that we saw over the course of our investigation is that data on the militarization of policing is really difficult to come by, and I think it's critical that people who live in the communities that are being policed demand to know how law enforcement is policing their communities and how law enforcement is spending their taxpayer dollars. So as a first step, make sure that there's transparency and oversight. Demand that police have policies in place that will limit the use of SWAT to situations when it's really necessary. Another thing that we think...
Short on time. Go ahead. Really quick.
Sure. So oversight boards. So we think that there should be local oversight boards to require local law enforcement agencies to justify their receipt of equipment from DOD.
All right. Kara Dansky from the ACLU, Radley Balco. He's the author of Rise of the Warrior Cop. This is The Source on KSTX. We'll be back after the NPR news.